President Putin again today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Vladimir Putin is sworn in for another term as Russia's president, but a former U.S. ambassador to Moscow says don't paint all of Russia with Putin's brush.
Not all Russians share Putin's view about the United States and the West, and I worry that we're oversimplifying what I think is, you know, an interesting, complex places where there's still a lot of people that would like a different relationship with the United States.
Plus, Afghanistan's first female Air Force pilot.
During the Taliban times, her father and her grandfather, they always dreamed of becoming pilots. But unfortunately, because of the Taliban, they weren't able to reach their dreams. It inspired her to want to become a pilot.
The latest chapter in her story and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World.
Путин вступил в должность президента России.
And with that, Vladimir Putin was sworn into office for another 6 years as Russia's president today, but not before crowds of Russians made it clear they don't approve. Down with the Tsar was a chant from protesters there in Moscow. Reporter Charles Maines was there for both events in the Russian capital, the protests and today's inauguration. Hey, Charles.
Hi, Marco. Good to be with you.
So let's start with the protests over the weekend. What did you see?
Well, I was at the protest in central Moscow at Pushkin Square. We had several thousand people out. There were, of course, other protests in cities across the country. They were heeding the call by the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, who had called for people to come out against Putin's six-year term under the slogan, he is not a czar to us, a reference, of course, to Putin's long-standing hold on power in Russia, now 18 years and counting. You know, it was a weird scene in Moscow because you had, of course, these younger Russians, mostly most of Navalny's followers are students, in fact. And they were saying, like, look, we tried to participate in these elections. Navalny was banned from the race. And so they say, you know, there's no place left for them on this but the street. And I want to introduce one guy that I spoke with. Georgi is his name. He's a student at a Moscow university. And he was also an election observer during this past presidential race. And let's listen to what he has to say.
Ну, если человек, который не готов мириться с отношением власти к народу.
And so you can hear those helicopters hovering overhead. Georgi was actually saying his voice is shot from all the shouting of these slogans of down with Putin, down with the Tsar. But what he's saying here is that, look, you know, he just doesn't agree with the way that the authorities in Russia deal with their own people. He'd been part of these election monitoring process. He'd watched this election unfold. He was angry about the fact that Alexei Navalny wasn't able to participate in the race. And he said that really the only thing left for him is to get out in the square and protest on the street.
And these protests were happening all over the country, right? I mean, these 1,600 arrests that we've been told about, that's not just in Moscow.
That's right. It's 700 arrests in Moscow and 1,300 detentions across the country. In fact, today we had courts starting to hand down sentences of 10 to 15 days to many of these protesters. And again, these are mostly students, which was very interesting given that Vladimir Putin's inauguration speech today was really forward-looking, talking about the value that youth has in building Russian society.
And today at the inauguration, what was the mood?
Well, it was, first of all, it's important to point out that this inauguration, you know, in terms of the optics, it was really designed to contrast with 2012. This is the last time Vladimir Putin went through this inauguration process. He was widely mocked after after they closed off all of central Moscow streets as his motorcades made its way into the Kremlin. And it just seemed to kind of, you know, accentuate this idea that he was out of touch with the people. This was at a moment when there were mass protests in the streets and a lot of Russians were being sort of hounded by police as Mr. Putin made his way to the Kremlin to take the oath of office. Now contrast that with this year, where the cameras cut to Mr. Putin. He's sitting in his office working with his jacket off, almost as though he's forgotten that there's an inauguration ceremony underway. He gets the call, sort of makes his way down to a car. The commentators point out that this car was Russian-made. He ditched his old Mercedes, which used to be the kind of the standard presidential vehicle. And that this would now be the official car going forward. And so he makes his way over to the Kremlin. And it was just a much more modest ceremony. Although, of course, once you're inside the Kremlin Hall, that's, of course, gilded and full of gold and all these dignitaries from Russia.
What has Putin promised to do as he heads off into this next 6 years of leading Russia?
Well, you know, his speech today was short. He took the oath of office and then made a short speech where he really promised continuity in terms of foreign policy, said that, you know, Russia was ready to defend itself at any point. But it was really focused on promising Russians that he was ready to build prosperity at home. I think it's no secret that Vladimir Putin's successes come more on the world stage. A lot of Russians who support him like the fact that he kind of sticks it to the West and has restored Russia's image, they feel, in terms of its sort of national pride in terms of global affairs. But the Russian economy is coming out of recession. It's been in recession for several years. And Mr. Putin was really saying today, look, I'm going to work on making lives better for you. But it was interesting also to see that Mr. Putin, after this ceremony, he stepped outside and met with young volunteers from his election campaign. You know, he's posing for selfies with, you know, students, chatting with them about their ideas about how to kind of build Russia up. So, you know, there are these two contrasting images, but I'm not sure that it's such a selling point, certainly to those people who were on the square in Moscow on Saturday.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Charles took pictures when he was out covering those protests in Moscow over the weekend. You can find them on our Instagram. Just look for us at PRI The World. With tensions currently high between Moscow and Washington, it's hard to believe that just a decade ago, U.S.-Russia relations were on reset and all about working together.
We got a big arms control agreement done, reducing by 30% the number of nuclear weapons in the world. New sanctions on Iran, a new supply route to Afghanistan, Russia into the World Trade Organization.
That's Michael McFaul. He was President Obama's ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 14. In his new book, From Cold War to Hot Peace, McFaul recalls how relations with the Kremlin went from reset to off the rails.
Obama sent me to Moscow to continue the reset, right? In 2012. I mean, we started to have this conversation in the beginning of 2011 at the height of cooperation. In fact, the peak of cooperation was a very specific moment. I remember it. It's when Medvedev went along with our decision by abstaining in a UN Security Council resolution vote.
And that was when Medvedev was president and Putin was prime minister, correct?
Right. Medvedev supported our military intervention into Libya. Putin did not. And for the first time ever, he criticized his president for being too close to the Americans. But I tell you all that because it was in the height of cooperation that Obama, you know, I wanted to go home. Most academics just spend a couple years in government. My family wanted to go home. And the president said, you can't leave now. We're doing all this great work towards Russia. Why don't you go to Moscow and continue it? By the time I arrived, Putin was running for president and coming back to the Kremlin. And two, there were massive demonstrations against Putin, against falsification in a parliamentary election in December 2011. And so he and his surrogates and his television stations, they began to go after us against America, Obama, and me, blaming us for those demonstrations and literally saying on national television that Obama sent me to Moscow to foment revolution against the Putin regime.
Some of the charges that were leveled against you when you were ambassador, honestly, quite shocking. And I'm just wondering, it's so outlandish. Do you see echoes now of perhaps the 2016 U.S. election and some of what we now call fake news?
Absolutely. The hardest argument was when they accused me of giving money to the opposition and I would say I'm not doing it. And they would Photoshop me, you know, appearing with demonstrators, Photoshop me, campaigning for Alexei Navalny one time. He was just arrested 2 days ago. The low point, without question, though, was when they put out a video that implied that I was a pedophile. It was early in my tenure. It was shocking, this eerie, strange video. And at the end of it is, McFaul is a pedophile. It appeared first on YouTube. And because I have friends at Google, we reached out to them. They took it down. But it immediately appeared other places. And how do you argue with that? How do you deal with that? I mean, even mentioning it right now, Marco, like, am I now somehow people are listening saying, oh, what does that mean?
Right.
I sometimes don't mention it. And that kind of disinformation, slicing and dicing, taking out the word not in things that I'd published, for instance, that was one thing they used to do. They do that at home, and they were doing it against us in 2012, and then they took it on the road. They went on the offense against our own country in 2016.
So what kind of a toll did that take on you personally?
Well, it was mixed because on the one hand, obviously nobody likes to be accused of being a pedophile. At the same time, I want to be clear, being the U.S. ambassador in Russia was a fantastic job. Mm. People wanted to engage with me even when it was dangerous. I became so popular among young people, Marco, that they banned me from speaking at universities.
Really?
And so, yeah. My house, Spasso House, it has a ballroom that seats over 600 people. So we began inviting those students to my house to do the lectures at Spasso House as a response.
So U.S. and Russia relations, I think you'd agree, are pretty at a pretty low point right now. And now it feels like the United States is almost characterizing an entire Russian nation. Is that where we're at now? Is this kind of like the response? And what's the danger in that?
Well, it is tragic, and I always hope for a different kind of relationship than we have now with Russia. However, I also fear the cartoonization in our own country about Russia, because Russia is a complex society. Not all Russians share Putin's view about the United States and the West, and I worry that we're oversimplifying what I think is, you know, an interesting, complex places where there's still a lot of people that would like a different relationship with the United States who are living inside Russia today. They may not be as vocal as they were before, but they're still present in that society.
Well, one simplification that we've seen in recent months and the last couple of years is we're in a new Cold War. And that leads us to the title of your book, From Cold War to Hot Peace. So we're in this hot peace moment and we're looking at the new START treaty. It's going to expire in 2021. And without a new deal, we've got these nuclear arsenals unconstrained, and it'll be the first time that way since 1972. Is this a new arms race? And how terrified should we be right now?
Vladimir Putin just last March revealed to the world some truly frightening weapons that they have, offensive weapons that we don't have a response to. We're also in a qualitative arms race regarding missile defenses, and we don't have an arms control regime in place to deal with that. And I think, tragically, we have to get back to the business of arms control like we did in the Cold War to at least make sure that we do not move in much more dangerous ways.
Yeah, and meantime, we think of the useful idiot template that the Russians love. And President Trump is caught up in the lives of porn stars. There is lawyers. Will he or won't he talk to Mueller? What of the whole ecosystem here that Trump lives in? What effect does that have on Russia right now and their ability, Putin's ability to do what he wants?
So far, the Kremlin is disappointed in what President Trump has delivered, particularly on sanctions. They hoped sanctions were going to be lifted. He hasn't delivered on that. At the same time, the disarray, polarization that we have inside our country, the scandals and investigations, and that which makes us distracted and turning inward as opposed to looking outward, that's all to Putin's advantage. If we're not on the international stage leading, that creates a vacuum that Putin and Russia can fill.
Are your friends, the people you still stay in touch with in Russia, are they uniformly anti-Putin?
No. Obviously, I know opposition leaders. I know Mr. Navalny. I know those kind of people. But I also have friends in the Russian government. I can't travel to Russia right now. I'm on the visa ban list. I'm on the sanctions list. But to be honest, I would like to go back.
What do you miss the most? Like, if you were to land in Moscow right now, what would be the first thing you'd do?
I would get together with some of my politically oriented friends, and we would have a 3 to 4 hour intense conversation in Russian. And my Russian's probably a little rusty now, so I'd have to fight to keep up, talking about the nature of what's going on probably inside Russia. I love lots of things about Russia, but the thing I love the most is the kind of intense friendships that I had. You know, you don't spend a lot of time talking about the weather in your friendships with Russia. And I miss those conversations. I miss them.
Michael McFaul was President Obama's ambassador to Russia. His new book is From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. Michael McFaul, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Nigeria's own problem with opioids, cough syrup addiction. That story just ahead here on The World.
This podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to our podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics with far-reaching implications, from how venture capital is fueling innovation, to the global shift toward renewable energy, to the economic impacts of President Trump's legislative agenda, and more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. An update now, courtesy of our Across Women's Lives desk. If you Google the name Niloufer Rahmani, you'll see these great pictures of this woman in front of a military jet. She's wearing a khaki jumpsuit and aviator sunglasses under her hijab. Back in 2012, Niloufer Rahmani became the first female pilot in the Afghan Air Force, part of the U.S.-led coalition fighting there. Her story was promoted by the government as a symbol of women's progress in Afghanistan. Then came the death threats against her and her family. 2 years ago, Niloufer Rahmani fled to the United States. That's when we first told you about her. And then, just last week, came the news that she was granted asylum here in the U.S. Kimberly Motley is her lawyer. So how did Niloufer react to finding out that she was granted asylum?
Niloufer was elated. I mean, she wasn't sure if it was going to be granted. And so she's very happy that she was granted asylum and so that she can continue to pursue her dreams.
And where is she now, Kimberly, and what are her plans?
Well, she's in the U.S., obviously. I don't want to share her specific location for security reasons. But her plans are she wants to continue to be a pilot. She wants to continue to fly. And hopefully by the fact that she has been granted asylum, there will be some airline or somebody that's willing to give, you know, Niloufer a chance to work for them as a pilot.
She said in one article I read recently that now that she's been granted asylum in the U.S., quote, "I can finally live my life in peace. Now all my worries are about my family in Afghanistan." What will happen to them?
Well, I mean, her family remains in Afghanistan. They remain very supportive of her, and they're just trying to live their lives, frankly. They've sort of been victims of significant death threats, unfortunately, and she does worry about that every single day. I mean, she's in constant contact with them to try to make sure that they're safe and everything, but it's a daily worry for her.
Do you think Rahmani's case is emblematic of what the U.S. has done or perhaps has failed to do for Afghan women?
I think Niloufer's case is not a failure of the U.S. government. So everything that the U.S. government did in support of Niloufer, they also had support of the Afghan government to promote her. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize that Afghanistan is one of the worst countries in the world to be a woman. But hopefully, people can look at her story, look at what she has done, and understand that even though she has gone through a lot in Afghanistan, now there are other Afghan female pilots that are in the Afghan Air Force who are trying to be successful in that field. And they would not have done that had they not had a Niloufer Rahmani example to follow.
So it's been a long, hard battle winning this asylum for Niloufer. 2 years is a long time to wait. How has it changed how she looks at the world?
Well, I mean, I think Niloufer is definitely appreciative of those that have supported her. She's been sort of not supported by people she was surprised that would support her. And she's more determined to become a pilot. She's more determined to be educated because she has been in this 2-year limbo. And she understands that the heavy burden that's been placed on her shoulders, that she has an obligation to be successful. And I think that's a heavy burden for any 26-year-old woman to carry.
Yeah. I'm just curious, has she ever told you, what does she love about flying?
Well, I think she hasn't specifically, but she told me why she wanted to become a pilot.
Why was that?
Well, basically, during the Taliban times, her father and her grandfather, they always dreamed of becoming pilots. But unfortunately, because of the Taliban, they weren't able to reach their dreams. So she always heard stories from her father about how he wanted to be a pilot, and she just sort of soaked that up. And from that experience, it inspired her to want to become a pilot. So she's fulfilling her dreams as well as her father's dreams.
So when she first applied for asylum 2 years ago, we spoke with you then and we had asked you if you had ever flown with her. At the time you said not yet. I'm just wondering if that's changed.
Not yet. I to be honest, I've never been on an airplane where I actually knew the pilot. So that would be a totally new experience for me, period.
Kimberly Motley, the lawyer for Niloufar Rahmani, thanks very much. Good to speak with you again.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Here in the U.S., we are used to hearing about the abuse of opioids through prescription medicines. In Nigeria, a similar problem, and until now, nobody's really talked about it. Codeine is also an addictive opioid, and in two states in Nigeria, it's estimated that as many as 3 million bottles of cough syrup containing codeine are drunk every day. My BBC colleague Adejuan Shoyinka has been investigating. He joins me from Nigeria's largest city, Lagos. So how addictive is this cough syrup? Does it really have that much codeine in it?
Oh, yeah. You know, what we found was pretty shocking. We found that, you know, young adults, even sometimes teenagers, are now abusing cough syrup with codeine. You know, you now have codeine parties.
Wow.
And people go to nightclubs where they are served codeine. The problem is very, very widespread. Like you mentioned, just two states of the Federation account for 3 million bottles per day, and you have 36 states in the country.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, those two states are in the north, Kano and Jigawa states. Do they really mirror addiction rates in other parts of the country?
Yes, I would say they mirror addiction rates across the country. Perhaps you may even have higher figures coming from a place like Lagos, considering the population of Lagos, and considering that Lagos is also the heart of the hospitality industry in Nigeria, where you have a lot of bars and clubs and hotels and all sorts of places where, you know, people now tend to abuse codeine.
So what effect does this cough syrup with codeine have on a person? Like, why is it so popular?
The effect it has on the body is debilitating. It makes you feel drowsy. It makes them feel slow. You know, they walk slowly, they talk slowly. You know, it just doesn't make sense, actually, personally to me, that anybody could have reasons to get high on cough syrup with codeine.
I mean, there have been correlations established between depression and opioid abuse here in the U.S., but is that the reason you think this addiction to codeine cough syrup is happening in Nigeria?
Yes, you can say a bit of it from that. There might be other factors too. Sometimes peer pressure among young people. Some of them feel like, oh, everybody's doing it, so I want to do it. Then there's also the dangerously deceptive nature of codeine. It comes across as harmless. You look at it like everybody takes cough syrup each time you have a cough or something. So some of them are even made with strawberry flavor, so it tastes nice. People just start abusing it without even knowing what they're doing. And before they realize what is happening to them, they are already hooked.
What has been the response of the Nigerian government to your investigation?
The story went viral across the continent, actually. And in Nigeria, we had a reaction from the wife of the president of Nigeria, Mrs. Aisha Buhari, put the story on a social platform. Then after that came a statement from the federal government, the Federal Ministry of Health, banning codeine cough syrup, banning the production and importation of codeine cough syrup in Nigeria.
I'm struck that this cough syrup story went viral across the continent. Are those other countries like Ghana and Kenya, are they saying they're also seeing the same trend with addictive substances?
Exactly. So the comments we've seen from all of those countries is that people are saying, oh, this is also a challenge in our own jurisdiction. I mean, you've got those kind of comments from Ghana, from Kenya, from Zimbabwe, from Uganda, you know, from across the continent. People saying, oh, this is also a challenge in our own country, and we need to tackle it with more seriousness.
My colleague at the BBC, Adejuan Shoyinka, speaking with us from Lagos. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's a fact of life. Attorneys are expensive. You're likely to pay around $300 an hour. That's just one reason why smart business owners turn to LegalZoom. In fact, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out with things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews. LegalZoom created their business legal plan to help you get legal advice for your business from vetted, independent attorneys and tax professionals available in every state. You also receive access to NDAs, lease agreements, and more. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Instead, you just pay one low upfront price. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan today and get special savings when you visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
I'm Marco Werman. Many Iraqi politicians want to distance themselves from the U.S., but one anti-corruption candidate in Iraq owes his reputation to America, sort of. He's the Iraqi who threw his shoe at President Bush.
In fact, he threw both of his shoes. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison.
Now he's running for the Iraqi parliament. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Voters who are fed up with politics as usual often turn to outsiders to shake things up. We've seen that happen here, but also in several other countries, like Italy. So let's spend a few minutes to see how populism is shaking out there. After elections in Italy in March, the anti-establishment five-star movement became the biggest single political party in the Italian parliament, but it fell short of an actual majority. Policy-wise, the five-star movement is a mix of, well, it's a mix of a lot of things. They include populism, anti-corruption zeal, skepticism regarding immigration and the EU, and progressive ideals. Now that idealism is hampering the movement from cutting the deals essential to forming a government in Italy. Reporter Darren Lucchetti's covers Italian politics and the five-star movement. He told me about one of the newly minted five-star members of parliament, Francesco Berti.
So I first met Francesco, I first talked to him in 2016, and back then he was just young 25-year-old activist in the grassroots of the movement. He was full of passion and enthusiasm and all that good stuff. And then I heard that he had put himself up to be a parliamentary candidate in December. And by March, he's a member of parliament at 27. So his kind of trajectory sort of mirrors the quick rise of Five Star Movement itself, really, because they only contested their first election in 2013.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say Berti kind of is a symbol for the whole five-star movement. He's young, he's idealistic, but also, would you say, inexperienced? I mean, is that maybe why the five-star movement is in the position it's in right now?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of an amazing experience that he agreed to give me a tour of the Italian parliament. And he said, you know, as we entered, everyone knows just by looking at me that I'm five star. You know, I think that's mostly because he's so young. The average parliamentarian's in their 50s in the Italian parliament. But he didn't completely know his way around the parliament yet. You know, he's just won his seat. So it felt, and he's a young guy. We got on well on a personal level, and it just felt a bit like we weren't meant to be there, that we're just sneaking around these grand corridors of, this 19th century palazzo where the parliament is.
I mean, I felt that in your story, that he was a little starstruck, but also is there some naivete there as well, too? Not just for Francesco Berti, but for the whole five-star movement.
Yeah. That's the thing. On the one hand, it's kind of encouraging to see this young politician who really genuinely seems to believe in making a difference. He's just there to try to give a voice to the people that have elected him and really just try to change things. But yeah, on the other hand, that's the critique that is constantly thrown at them, that they just, well, they have no experience as politicians. How can you just go from at 27, just suddenly step into parliament and be expected to be an effective lawmaker? Their answer to that question of, you know, are they too naive, would be that experienced career politicians in Italy have run the show for, you know, 40 years or whatever, and the country, they say, is in a mess. So why shouldn't the electorate try something new?
So for various reasons, the five-star movement has surged as this kind of outsider, not left nor right, really. How long can they keep up that image if they need to start cutting deals with, you know, the old-time politicians, the mainstream?
They always said that they would not form an alliance in government with anyone. And obviously, if they're talking to the centre-right and the centre-left about forming a government, they've changed their mind on that. I think the risk, especially with Italian politics, is that once you start cutting deals with the established parties whose name is tarnished in the eyes of much of the electorate, that, you know, it contaminates your party as well. But without making these compromises, it's hard to see how they're going to govern.
Darren, I spotted one seemingly very telling detail about the Five Star Movement in your story. They refuse to eat in the cafeteria in the Italian parliament along with other mainstream lawmakers. What is that all about?
Yeah, they have a few little things like this. So they will only eat in the general canteen, which is where, you know, staff and personnel and civil servants dine, I believe, because they think that their role as an elected representative is equal to that of a civil servant. They see being a parliamentarian as a civic duty, and so they think it's ridiculous that they should eat in a separate, grander restaurant reserved for parliamentarians.
Reporter Darren Lucchetti's telling us about Italy's upstart five-star movement. Thanks very much for your time, Darren.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Check out more of Darren's in-depth reporting from Italy at PRI.org. About 5 years after his famous mission accomplished moment aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, President George W. Bush was in Baghdad for a press conference. He was there to talk about the success of the U.S. invasion. Iraqi journalist Muntadir al-Zaidi was not pleased. He was the one who threw his shoes at Bush, shouting, "This is a goodbye kiss from the Iraqi people, dog. This is from the widows, the orphans, and those who were killed in Iraq." Muntadir al-Zaidi was sentenced to prison. When he was released, he moved to Beirut. But now he's back in Iraq, and he's running for parliament. Nabi Boulos is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. So take us back to 2008. Nabi, why did Muntadir al-Zaidi throw his shoes at Bush? It was a serious insult in that part of the world, wasn't it?
Of course. I mean, the fact is, in Iraq, if you even show the sole of your shoe to someone, that's already an insult, right? So throwing your shoe, as you can imagine, is the ultimate insult. And in fact, he threw both of his shoes. Although to Bush's credit, he managed to dodge both of them. So that is something, I suppose.
Yeah, quite skillful.
Yes. Muntadir was imprisoned after that, and he finally got out after 9 months for good behavior. But of course, he said at the time that he was tortured. He was beaten repeatedly in prison. And when he finally left, he was actually harassed all the time. So he finally left to Beirut and actually formed a humanitarian organization supporting victims of the U.S. invasion.
So have you spoken with him about why he came back now?
Yeah, I spoke to him. And he was saying that he had spent the last 10 years talking and reporting and complaining about the problems that Iraq has faced in the wake of the U.S. invasion. And he finally got tired of talking about it, is what he said. He said it was time to actually take some sort of action, to actually be proactive and try to change politics from within. That's why he was running. His entire platform now is anti-corruption. He's actually quite angry. And he says that he's not going to even be using the shoe-throwing incident as any kind of peg for his campaign. I mean, you don't see it featured in any of his campaign materials.
The media, though, seem to have cottoned onto this. I mean, headlines saying the Iraqi shoe-thrower is running for parliament. How well is he known in Iraq?
It was a historic moment in Iraq, to be clear, right? Throwing a shoe at a head of state, and especially one as powerful as George Bush was at the time, this was a huge deal. But his platform is focusing much more on the sort of everyday issues that are plaguing Iraq right now. And Iraq, as you know, especially in the wake of what happened, was just plagued with corruption. And in fact, right now, you have all these different officials that are in power who have been, you know, accused of mismanagement, of wide-scale financial malfeasance. And that's been his platform.
So I've read that there are actually murals in parts of Iraq honoring him. Is that true? And did throwing his shoes at Bush make him something of a folk hero?
Of course, no doubt. I mean, in fact, there are places where you'll find a statue of the shoe itself. In fact, I heard that one Saudi investor wanted to buy the shoe for $10 million.
Wow.
In fact, unfortunately, it's been destroyed. But yeah, it's not a part of his campaign, but it's certainly a huge part of his own reputation.
So now that he's back, I mean, what's changed since 2008? And do those changes suggest he has a real chance of becoming a member of parliament?
Yes, he's part of the Sa'irun coalition. So Sa'irun, which means marching, in this case, they're marching toward reform, is a list comprising Muqtada Sadr, the religious cleric, who's allied himself with six other secular parties, including the communists. His coalition, I mean, the Sa'irun, is in this unofficial poll that I've seen, is a group that's likely to gather the second highest number of seats in parliament. So actually, he does stand a decent chance of becoming part of the ruling parliament class at this point.
So al-Zaydi has also said eventually he wants to run for president. Is that a pipe dream, or do you think it could be real someday?
Well, in Iraq's constitution at this point, a president has to be a Kurd. So I'm not sure Mutavad is a Kurd, and I don't think he is. So it's probably a pipe dream. But who knows? I mean, the fact of the matter is times now in Iraq have changed after Islamic State, and reform is the biggest issue. Iraq is a dynamic country at this point. It is changing. And this election is going to change the course of the country for years to come. So anything is possible, I suppose.
Yeah. More importantly, perhaps, he also says he wants to hold the United States accountable for the years of war in Iraq. I mean, do you have a sense of what that means? Did he tell you?
Well, I spoke to him a little bit about that situation. And in fact, I talked to him about his enmity towards Bush. And he was saying that, in fact, he has no grudge against the American people. But the fact is that an invasion, no matter what justification it was under, was nevertheless wrong. And he wants to hold America accountable. But also, equally, he wants to hold the leaders that came in the wake of that invasion accountable, too, for the corruption. And he was saying that we've defeated the Islamic State, but now we have to defeat the Islamic State people in power, the Islamic State of corruption, the Islamic State of graft, etc. So it's not just America that's in his crosshairs. It's for sure corruption and the leaders that came out of that U.S. invasion.
Nabi Boulos, the Middle East correspondent for the L.A. Times, telling us about Muntarir al-Zaydi, the man who threw his shoes at George W. Bush in 2008, who's now running for parliament in Iraq. Nabi, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco. I appreciate it.
Last week, we told you about how U.S. funding for a group in Syria known as the White Helmets had been put on pause and is under official review. White Helmets is the nickname of Syria Civil Defense, a group of some 3,000 volunteers that's been doing humanitarian work in Syria since 2012. That includes rescuing the injured after government shelling in rebel-held areas. In some corners of the internet, though, a vastly different narrative about the group has been taking shape. Kate Starbird has been researching content, discrediting and criticizing the White Helmets' work in Syria. She and a team at the University of Washington recently released a paper on the subject. So I want to just start with something I thought was kind of refreshing coming from an academic paper, because you write that the process of trying to navigate this space, understanding the competing narrative surrounding the White Helmets, was, quote, intensely disorienting, not just for you, but for your whole team. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, so we started last summer, and we spent months. We read this content. We read the articles. We read the tweets. We really tried to engage in it. And as we were doing that, you know, even individually, we recognized that the way the content is presented is very compelling, and there were a lot of different kinds of things, and the way the evidence was presented, it just generated a lot of doubt among our research team. And that's, you know, that's what it's designed to do in many ways. If you look at these kind of information campaigns or information operations, is one of the goals is just to be disorienting and to create doubt and confusion. And it's very effective.
Now, a lot of the anti-White Helmet narratives took shape across what you call alternative media. So explain what falls under that category and just give us some examples of the narratives that you observed that were anti-White Helmet.
So some of the sites, we call them alternative media, but they call themselves alternative or independent media. They use terms like awakened to talk about the people that might want to go there. RT is a part of this. They use the slogan question more. So these are a lot of websites that purposely present themselves as alternatives to mainstream Western media.
Right. And RT, of course, is funded by the Russian government.
RT is funded by the Russian government. So there's others in there. Sputnik News is in there. We've also seen websites that have connections to the Iranian government and some other accounts and things that seem to be non-state actors that also have interests in that group that are aligned with Iran and Syria and Russia, and as well as a lot of other kinds of sites that it's more difficult to unwind what their targets are. So there's a lot of different sites that have different wrappers around them that might be targeted towards libertarians or the alt-right or the far left. From the superficial view, these sites kind of could look very different, and yet they're very similar content that's showing up across them, especially when it comes to the White Helmets.
What kind of narratives did you see in that alternative space about the White Helmets?
Yeah, so a few different narratives that we might see are that the White Helmets are terrorists, or that they work with terrorists, that the White Helmets are a propaganda construct from the West, that they're a political tool or political arm of U.S. or NATO. And also that the White Helmets stage events such as chemical attacks or other kinds of things in order to make the Syrian government look bad.
So you describe the environment in which the anti-white helmet narratives were constructed, shaped, and propagated as an ecosystem as opposed to an ecosystem. I'm kind of getting a sense of why, just from what you're saying.
Yeah, so when you go online and you go to do your research, in fact, these websites encourage you to do your own research, and you go into this space, you see that all these different websites, these very different websites, are talking about some of these same narratives, that the white helmets are bad, that they're terrorists. And after you kind of look a little bit deeper, you begin to realize that it's actually the same article or the same author or the same content. Maybe it's fully copied or maybe it's a little remixed, but it's appearing on many different sites. And some of the most interesting things is the same article can appear across two sites that look like a far right and a far left site are both putting out the same kind of anti-white helmets content, literally the same article.
So as far as freezing U.S. funding for the white helmets, do you have any sense whether the false narratives of the white about the white helmets have fed into this change?
Yeah, I can't even speculate on that. We have seen that these false narratives they're out there and they may be on the rise, in fact. But I don't know if that played into it or not. We can't know why people make decisions right now. And in those places, it's not very transparent.
Kate Starboard with the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering at the University of Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The tiny kingdom of Bhutan in Asia has a reputation as a happy place, very chill. You've probably heard of its gross national happiness index. It's been written into the country's constitution as a guiding principle of government, deeply rooted in Buddhism. But there's also another Bhutan, the one that's grappling with a mental health crisis, including a rising number of suicides. Emily Johnson traveled to the capital, Thimphu, to look at how they're dealing with the problem.
Jeremy Choing sits at a cafe on a mild day in January. He's got dark glasses, tattoos covering his forearms, long hair, and a goatee. Today is a good day. He's about to pick up the first copies of his new book.
Book of poetry called Ballad of a Minor Man in a Major Chord.
As a young man in the mid-90s, the sleepy pace of life in the isolated kingdom made him restless. He started getting into prescription drugs. And then he got obsessed with death, reading texts like the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
More or less, I think there was kind of a morbid fascination with death and dying.
Suicide violates the first precept of Buddhism, do not kill. But it didn't register with him at the time.
I didn't really have a reason per se, you know, that this is, I didn't plan it. You know, I did not sit down and think, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I want to end my life, because none of it makes any sense and there's no meaning to, you know, any of it. So I think mine was kind of a very pathetic, ignorant state of abject hopelessness.
One day, when he was 26, he pulled the rope belt off his traditional robe and tried to hang himself.
Thankfully, I had a girlfriend at the time who happened to knock on the door and heard no answer and panicked and you know, and people crashed in through, and yeah, they saved my life. So I owe them a big debt of gratitude.
Choing didn't know it, but his brush with death happened at a pivotal moment for Bhutan. It was 1999, the year two significant things happened here. One was the legalization of television and the internet. That's right, Bhutan didn't have TV or the web until the last years of the 20th century. It's hard to overstate the impact of this sudden incursion of globalization into people's homes.
Even in those far-flung villages now, they have television access. You can imagine, the social media now is everywhere. And so things have changed so much, especially in the last, I would say, 10 years. Just too fast, I suppose.
The other event? The arrival of Bhutan's first psychiatrist, Dr. Chenjo Dorji. He went to Sri Lanka to study psychiatry, inspired by his brother, a Buddhist monk who suffers from schizophrenia. When Dr. Chenjo came home, he pushed for the creation of Bhutan's first psychiatric ward in Thimphu and began training doctors around the country in basic mental health assessment and treatment.
We have been trying relentlessly to educate our people, to inform our people on mental disorders, and that there is treatment available now.
Two more psychiatrists have since joined him on the ward, but in a country of 800,000 people, it's nowhere near enough. Convincing people of the value of psychiatric care has also been a challenge. Most Bhutanese are more likely to complain of being afflicted by deities than depression and seek help from shamans. Dr. Chencho says he wouldn't discourage that, but hopes people will see the merit of both options. So he's tried to find creative ways to get his message out.
Kusasangpo and welcome to Mind Over Matter Bhutan. I am Nam Gizam and with me in the studio today is Dr. Tsenchu. Thank you for coming back to Mind Over Matter Bhutan.
I'm in the studio at Radio Valley watching Dr. Tsenchu do one of his frequent guest spots on Bhutan's new mental health talk show.
It's one strategy, but I'm asking you a question. You see the bear there, what do you want to do?
I will run, doctor. What will I do?
You'll run. Okay.
I can't just... Doctor, I've watched...
So that's called flight.
Yes, flight. Flight.
He and the host, Namge Zam, have the banter thing down.
Last year,
Zam is a prominent journalist who broke a story about the results of Bhutan's first comprehensive suicide survey in 2014.
The statistics were quite shocking, and also it debunked a lot of myths.
Her research on the story and the back-to-back suicides of two people close to her family made her realize how great a need there was for public engagement around mental health. Guests on the show have included counselors as well as suicide survivors, including Jeremy Choing. The station broadcasts to the Greater Thimphu area and online, which means the audience is mostly literate young people who speak English. But Zam wants to reach beyond them.
There's no vocabulary in Dzongkha like to really discuss mental health like we would. Like, you know, you can say you're experiencing depression and anxiety in English. Now, how do you translate this into Dzongkha? So if you translate this, you say, it's like you're mentally ill. Like, that's it. Like, there's no way to describe it further. So the people we need to reach are the ones who don't understand English. So, yeah, it's going to happen soon. I think maybe in a year or so, then we will start catering to that audience as well and using social media platforms to get to them.
There are other signs of change. 147 newly certified mental health counselors have come on board since 2013, and a new program in social work is set to launch at the Royal University of Bhutan next year. It will be modeled on social work programs in other countries, but with a Bhutanese twist. It will be grounded in the philosophy of Buddhism. For The World, Emily Johnson, Thimphu, Bhutan.
Emily's reporting was made possible by a grant from the International Reporting Project. Finally today, when most kids choose their first instrument, it may be the clarinet or trumpet. In my case, it was the piano. For Kais Azar, his instrument was the rabab, an instrument with ancient roots in Afghanistan.
I was introduced to the instrument initially by my father, and it was kind of like an instant fit. The rabab has a very kind of haunting tone. It's a very big sound, and it's got this almost like natural reverb that makes it sound as if it's, you know, 50 feet wide. I grew up in the West, and the one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that when I began my formal music education at the age of 7 or 8, in Eastern classical music, I also began formal training in Western classical music and Western theory. And so these two have paralleled each other. The Ghost You Love Most is a good representation of the new work. And that's more or less just moving forward with the goal that I've had in mind in composition, and that's interweaving music from here and there into one kind of presentation, kind of a way of weaving together different cultures and different music to, you know, start this new global genre.
Composer and musician Kais Azar there with a big forward-thinking sound on the rabab. This is the title track from his new album, The Ghost You Love Most. We'll leave the last notes to Kais today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.